The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckleberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it all begins after what seems like a whole year of campaigning. The Iowa cornflakes come out of the box and actually choose candidates today. The first ritual of American democracy gets underway. We recall and explore the Iowa ground game and what it teaches about the soul of rural America every 4 years. This hour, carnage and constructive dialogue in Syria. We imagine a world without mosquitoes, and we actually go there.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
We are ready for the event.
WNYC Radio, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
That's right. We will check in with some astronauts on the International Space Station later this hour. They left their mosquitoes behind when they left Earth and have a hard time picking out crucial Mason City from space. That's a city in Iowa. What's it like to do Iowa from the ground, street to street, neighborhood to neighborhood? Well, for our politics this morning, Brad Anderson toured all 99 counties with John Edwards back in 2004. He was Iowa State Director for President Barack Obama's reelection campaign in 2012. This year, he's thrown his support behind Hillary Clinton. Brad says it's the one-on-one, straight-ahead retail politics that makes Iowa so unique that Iowans consider it an enormous privilege every 4 years.
It's something that you don't really see in other states. And when you have a question for a presidential candidate here in Iowa, you either wait for that person to come to your town that you can ask the person directly, or you can ask the staff, which is typically campaigns have staff that are on the ground throughout the state, or, you know, you might even run into a candidate at the state fair on the way to get a pork chop. So there's a lot of one-on-one personal interaction, and that's what really makes Iowa unique.
Describe how in individual communities, my sister-in-law, for instance, in Dubuque, is essentially the Democratic Party boss in Dubuque, you know, every 4 years. It's possible for someone who is more or less, you know, elementary school teacher by day to become a real political future maker in Iowa, where that's not the case elsewhere.
Yeah, I think there are activists that certainly have day jobs, and they take their role in caucus organizing very seriously. And for example, you know, on the Democratic side, we have 1,681 precincts across the state. And if you're a campaign, if you're Bernie Sanders campaign, or if you're the Hillary Clinton campaign, you want to make sure that you find a precinct captain in each of those precincts. They gather volunteers and they figure out the caucus math on caucus day, and they're there to fight for their candidate. And then you are talking about school teachers and social workers and, you know, speech therapists and all kinds of fields that are not political operatives, but certainly they almost become political operatives on caucus night. And it's a fascinating process to watch. Just on the way here to talk with you, I was driving and I ran into Bill Clinton in his motorcade that was at a coffee shop, and I had to kind of swerve over to the right. And it's something that's unique and one of those only in Iowa moments.
What is a 99-county strategy?
Well, a 99-county strategy, of course, is when a candidate goes to visit all 99 counties. And the strategic reason behind it is because on the Democratic side, the way the math works, you know, running up the score in an urban area, you're still only awarded a certain number of delegates. So in a Des Moines precinct, for example, that has 11 delegates, whether you get 300 people there supporting you, 500, it doesn't matter. You're still only awarded 11 delegates. But if you go to a place like Clinton, it's considered kind of more efficient because there are fewer people there to organize. and the delegate math works to your advantage if you can get your people there. And so the supporter to delegate ratio is smaller in some of these rural places throughout the state. And it's designed that way to kind of force campaigns and organizations to go outside of Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and Davenport to get their votes. And so when you have a 99-county operation, you've got one that is statewide and that understands the delegate math really well. And, you know, on this campaign, I can tell you Clinton was on the ground in April with 30 staff. And by August, she identified a supporter in every single one of the 1,681 precincts. And this happened in August. And I was so stunned. I had not endorsed anyone at that time. I actually called the Clinton campaign. I said, how did you do that? Because some of these precincts have four or five Democrats total. And they said they had campaign staff waiting in gravel driveways for people to get home from work just to make sure that they could make this announcement.
Would you say that social media and digital tools obviate the need for having to travel to all 99 counties, or do you still have to go, you know, meet the face-to-face important people in every precinct?
The important role that social media has played is really for events. And I go back to Bernie Sanders earlier this year in Davenport. He had 2,500 people show up at a Sanders event. This is early in 2015. How did he do it? He did it with a Facebook invitation. I mean, he only had two staff on the ground and he had people turn out, and it was because of a Facebook invitation. So I think getting people to turn out for events, social media plays a role. But when it comes to getting people to turn out on caucus night, that means asking someone to put on a jacket, turn on their car, drive to a caucus location, and caucus for a candidate for 2 hours. That requires a personal commitment. And the most effective way to get that commitment is a one-on-one interaction with someone on the ground. Because when an Iowan tells you, okay, I'll be there for you on caucus night, they mean it. And to get a verbal commitment, or in a lot of cases, a written commitment, that kind of commitment matters to the people of Iowa. And so that's where you can't replace that with social media. You really can't.
You know the state pretty well, I would say, by now, right?
I would. I've been to all 99 counties, yes.
What is your favorite place to go to that, you know, doesn't require me giving you the sort of flashcard treatment here?
The hidden gem is Archie's in Lamar's. It's an unbelievable steakhouse. Everyone, of course, all the fancy reporters, all you guys, you know, you always want to go to 801 Grand in Des Moines, and that's a fancy steakhouse that on any given day you'll see Tom Brokaw or Mark Halperin or whoever. But Archie's in Lamar's, if you're ever in Iowa, in Plymouth County, go to Archie's. Trust me, you won't regret it.
Brad Anderson, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Brad Anderson is a Hillary Clinton supporter in Iowa. He was Iowa State Director for President Obama's reelection campaign in 2012. In Geneva, Switzerland, Secretary of State John Kerry is trying to push a political solution to the war in Syria. But 5 years after the first shots were fired, certainly Syrians have reason to doubt and hope as Kerry begins again in Geneva.
Without negotiations, the bloodshed will drag on until the last city is reduced to rubble and virtually every home, every form of infrastructure, and every semblance of civilization is destroyed.
The Syrian opposition coalition refuses to negotiate with President Bashar al-Assad until the government agrees to end a siege against civilian areas, including the town of Madaya, where many are reported starving to death. Joining us is Robin Wright, a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Robin, welcome back.
Great to be with you, John.
Where do these talks stand with Secretary of State John Kerry? He's had enormous success elsewhere diplomatically, not much here.
Well, the United States has played a key role in mobilizing the 17 international countries that are involved in some way, and they have stood as one in trying to pressure the diverse sides on the government and the rebel opposition to come to the negotiating table. The big gap, of course, is that the Islamic State is not party to the negotiations, and that makes the prospects, even if you should by some miracle get an agreement, vulnerable to the fact that the Islamic State controls a third of Syria.
Let's just say I'm an opposition member, with an AK-47, but I'm not an ISIS member, but I don't like Bashar al-Assad, and I'm a Sunni Muslim. I look around and I see the United States has made a deal with the Shiites in Iran, although they don't support Hezbollah, who's Bashar al-Assad's ally, and they claim they're trying to get rid of ISIS, but they support the Kurds over here on the other side. What am I to make of the U.S. position and who they're actually allied with at this point? It seems very, very confusing from the perspective of your average insurgent.
Well, you've underscored one of the basic facts of and basic challenges of the negotiating process, and that is that there are four different wars that are playing out in Syria. There's the war between the government of President Assad and the various rebel opposition groups, and there are dozens of them. Then you have the war between ISIS and both the rebel opposition and, to a lesser extent, the government. Then you have that sectarian dimension that plays out between the larger community among Sunnis and the smaller Alawites. And then you have the proxy wars that are playing out between among the international players. And so that Sunni rebel you talked about looks at the horizon and feels very vulnerable that even if he compromises, that the prospects of getting the kind of security and return to normalcy and political participation that this is ultimately about seem pretty slim.
Robin Wright, is the region coming to the grim conclusion that this is a kind of a partition where Bashar al-Assad gets Damascus, that ISIS gets to keep its chunk of Syria and maybe a little bit of Iraq, and the Kurds get their territory in the north?
It's clear that the question of Syria's longevity is also on the table, and whether as part of the transition process, peace process, that you lock into place those powers, the various different powers that control areas. The question, of course, is what do you do about ISIS? Because both the United States and the Russians, who back different sides in this conflict, are determined to eliminate ISIS. The question is, can you defeat it militarily? And the conclusion by everyone is, no, you can't. You have to solve Syria politically. But that's really probably the toughest part of what is the most difficult peace process ever undertaken in the Middle East.
Robin Wright is a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
The universe was created in 7 days, says the biblical creation myth. I figure somebody did mosquitoes a few weeks later after some very wild party where someone asked, what could we create that would just absolutely annoy humans? They say it was that eating of the apple from the tree of knowledge business that caused Adam and Eve to put on their clothes. No, I don't think so. It was the mosquitoes. Hello? And the problems have never stopped. Carriers of all kinds of deadly diseases, mosquitoes, are credited with half of all human deaths since the Stone Age.
Some say the bugs were provoked by the intrusion of humans into their natural habitat, that a live and let live policy is preferable to war with the bugs.
Let me tell you something. I say kill them all!
That moral debate on insecticide is from the fictional movie Starship Troopers, but in reality, the World Health Organization is convening an emergency panel today to discuss steps to control the spread of the mosquito-borne virus Zika, which is spreading throughout Latin America and has affected dozens of people here in the United States. Here to discuss it all is Joseph Conlon, retired U.S. Navy entomologist, who has studied mosquitoes in 37 different countries and is now a technical director for the American Mosquito Control Association.
Mosquitoes themselves don't occupy any unassailable niche in the food chain. If mosquitoes went away tomorrow, the ecosystem would probably hiccup for a while, then pull itself up by its bootstraps and continue to march. We got through the dinosaurs becoming extinct. If mosquitoes became extinct, it wouldn't hurt things all that much.
Could we get rid of mosquitoes short of actually crashing an asteroid into the United States or into the planet?
Probably not, and only insofar as that in getting rid of them, there would probably be too much in collateral environmental damage involved, because you'd have to use a number of different methods, and we're not entirely sure how some of these methods in the long term would affect things beyond mosquitoes. And by that I mean not, you know, depriving things of food resources, but in terms of you know, chromosomal abnormalities and all kinds of strange things like that. So no, what we're only trying to do now is reduce the problem to a tolerable level, whether it be nuisance and or disease.
Are mosquito larvae a food source for fish?
Indeed, but they're not the only food source for fish. And we must remember that the availability of prey organisms reduces the number of predators, and not the opposite. What you don't want to do is overload an ecosystem with predators, because then you get into real problems, because they start eating stuff that you don't want them to eat, and then you have to get rid of the predators, and that's a very, very difficult thing to do.
So, all right, you work for the U.S. Navy, right?
Indeed, right.
I mean, now naval guys are known for, like, big ideas, you know. I mean, John, we can actually move North America over to Asia, and here's how we'll do it. Well, you know, I mean, you could actually do something as ridiculous as get rid of a mosquito. How would you do it?
Probably I would do it via genetically modifying mosquitoes and or introducing a lethal substance into their food chain that was specific to them. And people are working on that. But nature always sides with the hidden flaw, and we must be very, very careful about doing genetically modified, gene-driven things to mosquitoes, because we're not entirely sure what the outcome will be.
Short of making mosquitoes not bite humans, can you make it possible for mosquitoes to never have a dangerous virus in their stomachs?
There are ways of doing that, actually. There's a particular bacteria called Wolbachia, which resides in about 40 to 60% of insects, but it doesn't reside in mosquitoes. And researchers have found that if you introduce this particular bacteria into the mosquito's gut, it prevents transmission of dengue fever and lowers the amount of chikungunya virus that can be transmitted. So there is some research going on in that regard. However, introducing the Wolbachia bacteria into the mosquitoes, the logistics required in that are rather difficult.
And Joe, where do you live?
I live in Fleming Island, Florida, which is about 8 miles south of Jacksonville.
So what's your approach? What is the Joseph Conlin, retired U.S. Navy entomologist, strategy for dealing with mosquitoes every year?
When I am on my porch, I use floor fans, because a reasonable breeze will keep mosquitoes off of you. And I also use repellents, Picaridin in particular. I used to use DEET, and when I was in the Navy, we used DEET, and I'm a great believer in it. But I just prefer Picaridin products over DEET, because they don't smell as bad, and they're kind of a light feel. I'll wear long sleeves and long pants when I can. So those are the things that I do. I don't have any control issues at all. And frankly, I live right next to a swamp. Now, maybe they know who they're messing with and they're not coming to get me. I don't know.
It sounds like they might. With the Zika virus crisis that seems to be brewing here, do you suspect that there will be any new mass scale eradication techniques tried as a result of this?
Yes, I do. Not in the United States. They'll be tried elsewhere. There are a number of different summit conferences being organized even as we speak, that are trying to address a sustainable strategy for reducing populations of Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, which is primarily responsible for transmitting this virus. What is interesting and kind of concerning, though, is that there's a possibility that one of the Aedes aegypti's relatives, called Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito, could be involved with transmission too. And even worse than that, some people are suggesting that Culex pipiens, the basic one each government issue house mosquito, could be involved in transmission, which might explain the rapid increase in cases in Brazil. If that's the case, Culex pipiens is quite common here throughout the United States, is the primary transmitter of West Nile virus. And if it got somehow involved with the transmission cycle here in the United States, it could be disastrous. I kind of doubt that that's going to happen, though.
Joe Conlin is a retired U.S. Navy entomologist and technical advisor for the American Mosquito Control Association. Joe, I can't tell you how happy I am you're on the job.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Take care.
You too.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It was 8 years ago, and one Senator Barack Hussein Obama was looking at an uphill battle to the White House. Today, he is looking back at 8 years of being in the White House and seeing the racial divisions and the common ground he's helped to create during that time. Michael Eric Dyson says President Obama stands at the center of a racial conversation that is rapidly changing. Americans recognize racial violence is no accident, but arises out of radically different understandings of our history. Obama has become someone who has to be both a symbol of racial progress and a leader who must articulate difficult messages about racial violence, unsettled scores, and the search for peace. James Baldwin would refer to this weight of leadership as the burden of representation. It's a burden that Dyson explores in his new book, The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America, out tomorrow. Professor Michael Eric Dyson from Georgetown University joins me in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I grew up as a reporter covering Harold Washington in Chicago. Barack Obama grew up as an activist watching Harold Washington in Chicago, who was shut down by the white political establishment in the city council in Chicago.
Vrdoljak and those guys.
That's right. Washington understood he was shut down. He also understood it was racist. And he didn't make any bones about that. But he also campaigned in white neighborhoods and said, I will win them one at a time. And you'd go to his campaign events in Cicero where there was no blacks. And he'd campaign and he'd come back to the black churches and he would say, speaking in a very different voice, I don't care what you think. I'm turning them one at a time. I see them out in the audience. I see their eyes turning. I see it. Did Barack Obama learn any lessons from Harold Washington?
Well, he learned some positive lessons in taking that particular playbook and understanding that you got to go upstate, downstate. You got to go to Springfield as well as Chicago. Barack Obama was a genius at that.
Does he think it's racism, though, that the Congress is shutting him down?
He probably does privately. He probably does. He would be loath to say that publicly because he never wants to be seen as crying in his beer. The people elected him to govern, and he wants to do that. Now, there's something heroic in that stoicism, but there's also something that lacks a kind of engagement with a racial crisis that might teach the lesson some the nation some important lessons. So he wouldn't call racism, he wouldn't cry, but he recognizes it. And if you talk to him personally, he does. And then in his public speech, he began to acknowledge it. The speech at Selma for the 50th anniversary, his speech or his sermon, if you will, at the church in for the funeral of Clemente Pinckney. The murdered minister and politician there. Race became a central, if you will, category of his analysis and forced Obama to use the brilliance he has on race finally in application to public policy and to speak from his bully pulpit to articulate a vision that could be helpful to the nation.
Did the speech about Jeremiah Wright, about his minister during the campaign, was that a speech trying to dispel race as an issue? And by the time you get to Charleston, Obama has realized almost on a Shakespearean level that, no, race is the issue. You don't dispel it.
He always knew it, but he figured in terms of his modus operandi, his strategy was to minimize its impact. Even when he gave that Jeremiah Wright speech, which was an impossible balancing act. On the one hand, he's got to reassure white folk that he is not some raging privately, you know, raging black man who has privately nursed resentment against white America. And on the other hand, he can't diss his pastor because black people hold the pastor up there right next to mama. Mama, then pastor. So he can't be seen as, you know, engaging in some very unscrupulous practices toward the man who nurtured his own spiritual rebirth. So he did that in a way, although I take quite a while in my book to talk about that speech and to talk about the great and heroic elements of that speech and some of the problematic and troubling aspects, the false equivalency between white anger now and black anger in the past. But black anger presently is something that Barack Obama has shunned. So to answer your question the roundabout way, Barack Obama has held at arm's length the articulation of black rage and anger and disgruntlement in the present time, trying to hold at bay the vicious white supremacist and obstructionist impulses of the far, far lunatic right, and at the same time trying to engage the nation in helpful conversations about race now. You're absolutely right. By the time he gets to Charleston, all bets are off. You can't avoid it. You can't minimize it. You can't put it on the back burner. And you've got to speak to it in a way that will be uplifting and helpful. And don't simply, you know, if you will, lecture black America. Don't point your finger in the faces of the vulnerable, but organize a kind of passion for racial justice that you were at your best doing when you were a community organizer and, if you will, a freshman politician.
Did you at the time feel that he was being too reticent?
Yes, of course. And I said so lovingly because I was twice a surrogate for Barack Obama for president because I believed in the man and still do. I think he'll go down as one of the greatest presidents we've had. But the issue of race will not win him those plaudits because of his reticence, because of his understandable, if you will, hesitation to engage the issue of race. But I think that if he understood earlier that you have the bully pulpit, you got the microphone for 8 years. These are things that you can do to make this nation better and to confront issues that perhaps you didn't want to necessarily confront, but you were forced into confronting. Every great president has been forced to do so, from Lincoln down to LBJ. These who are the greatest presidents, those who are our most outstanding leaders, were forced into a situation that they then embraced and ran with it. And I think Barack Obama has come late to the game, but has made some interesting strides in the aftermath of it.
So who leads from here? What is the leadership moment at the end of the Obama administration? Is it to move this forward, and who do you see doing that? Or is it the pendulum swinging back, as happens all the time in America? And you can hear some of that in the echoes of the rhetoric in the GOP.
Well, there is an Edgar Allan Poe kind of pendulum swinging moment here, racially speaking. I think that the nation will continue to make progress if a Hillary Clinton, for example, is elected as the first female president. It won't make as big a difference as it might otherwise have made because Barack Obama has cleared the hurdle for difference by being the first black president. So he has cleared the path for her in some ways and then opened the door to a potential 16-year stretch where a white male was not at the helm of the American government. That alone, that fact, symbolically speaking, is quite extraordinary. But in terms of the public policies that can be put forth, I think a white female president like, say, for instance, Hillary Clinton, or should Bernie Sanders get in office, could make a huge difference in terms of the public policies that defend the interests of a vulnerable population like African-American people.
Michael Eric Dyson is professor of sociology at Georgetown University, author of The Black Presidency, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Race in America, out this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Ben from Bainbridge Island. I just wanted to say, as a sailor, I rely really heavily on GPS. Certainly plan to learn celestial navigation, but until then, GPS is really a godsend. I just did my first trip, coastal trip, from San Diego to Seattle, and GPS not only gives you real peace of mind, but it actually provides a real safety.
You have reached your destination.
You know, it's hard to imagine that in our own lifetimes, actual maps that you can hold in your hands will just vanish, replaced by GPS images and those voices all coming from digital screens. GPS's power as an American innovation is still muscling its way into every cultural nook and cranny. But that's how really great innovations work. In week two of the Takeaways search for America's greatest innovation, we're going to add GPS to the already nominated electric guitar, sewing machine, Kevlar hearing aid, and the air conditioner. We have four more to pitch this week, and then on Friday, your selection, your listener wildcard. You can see the full list and vote for your favorite or nominate your own at thetakeaway.org/innovation. Can you imagine a world without GPS? It's getting harder and harder.
Hi, I'm Christopher Catrimbone. I'm the co-founder of the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, or MOAS, and I spend most of my time at sea. The reason why I set up MOAS and why I want you to value GPS as much as I do has nothing to do with being able to easily find my nearest Starbucks. It has everything to do with the world's biggest refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War. As we speak, there are hundreds, probably thousands of refugees adrift at sea. These families don't often know where they are or where they're heading. GPS not only tells me where I am, but it also shows me and my team where we can safely take those we are able to rescue. Of course, you'll know GPS does so much more. This amazing system uses more than 24 satellites in outer space, all equipped with transmitters and atomic clocks. But here's why I think the Global Positioning System is America's best innovation. Beyond its ability to pinpoint my exact location with incredible accuracy, GPS simply saves lives. It's an invention that can help us track down those in distress or caught up in a disaster faster than ever before. The minutes saved here, we know, can often make the difference between life and death.
Turn right onto Northside Drive Southwest.
The world's first GPS satellites were launched in 1978. Come 1993, the system was fully operational, and a few years later, GPS fundamentally changed the way we view our world when President Bill Clinton made the system available to the private sector, and it's the reason why you can navigate the planet from the palm of your hand.
Recalculating.
And even for those lost at sea, it will determine not just where they are, but where they are going.
Chris Catrimbone for GPS. And you have your own nominees.
Terry Brewster from Brewstertown, Tennessee. My nomination for the best U.S. innovation is the U.S. patent system that allows people besides those who get favor with the king to get a patent, because without it, a lot of things would not have come about, or they would have all been corporation products.
This is Butch Clark in beautiful Euless, Texas. I thought about your innovations, and I thought you ought to consider judicial review as one of the greatest innovations of all time. It confirmed our three levels of government, something that's never seen before in history. And it's confirmed every day, every time we see the Supreme Court address another issue.
This is Gar in Seattle. My nomination for greatest invention ever, the bicycle. And then I would also put in painless dentistry.
Visit thetakeaway.org/innovation to formally nominate an invention for this challenge or vote for one you've heard on the air. Again, that's thetakeaway.org/innovation and make your voice heard.
Support for the search for America's greatest innovation is provided in part by the Lemelson Foundation.
If humans make it to Mars, it will be on a ladder of technological innovations, some that preceded the first launch, some that have come after the space program, and many, many more yet to come. If you've seen the movie The Martian, actor Matt Damon has to improvise all kinds of technology to survive being stranded. His crew has to do the same to rescue him. Getting to Mars is very much the mission of the International Space Station right now. We spoke with two astronauts on the ISS, Scott Kelly and Shell Lindgren, last October. Shell has since returned home to Earth, but Scott is still completing his one-year mission, a lengthy experiment designed to see how the human body and the human mind can respond to innovations to condition it to handle being in outer space for long periods of time. Scott and Shell are natural space travelers and would love to be a part of a Mars mission.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
We are ready for the event.
WNYC Radio, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
Station, this is WNYC Radio. How do you hear me?
Hey, we have you loud and clear. How do you hear us?
Sounds great.
This is Chell, and Scott's here as well.
All right, great. How's your day going?
We're busy today. We're doing a little bit of science, but mainly getting ready for the spacewalks that we have coming up next week.
And what will those spacewalks entail, Scott?
Well, the one next week, we refer to it as a space station upgrades. You know, some of the stuff is to improve the capability of the space station. We're going to run a bunch of cables that will allow for commercial crew vehicles to someday dock with the space station. But in addition to that, we're doing some repairs of some things. There's this alpha magnetic spectrometer that's having some cooling issues. We're going to put some insulating blankets on it, and our robot arm has a sticky end effector that I'm going to lubricate, and we have some other activities in that spacewalk as well.
Those sticky end effectors, I hate those.
Yeah, they can be a problem.
Well, I'm sure the view will be spectacular. You know, our motivation to talk with you, Michelle and Scott, is all about innovation and the kinds of innovation that enables the International Space Station to operate. But it sounds like a lot of what you do is very low-tech improvisation and kind of make do with what you have.
I don't know if that's the right way to characterize it. It's a pretty high-tech laboratory we have here. And, the systems that keep us alive are, kind of state-of-the-art. The environmental control system we have takes our urine, turns it into water. We turn that water into oxygen. We scrub, carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And from the system that creates electricity, we take that hydrogen and the oxygen from the CO2, and then we make more water. It's kind of this closed-loop system that's pretty incredible. From a science perspective, we have a combustion rack that every time I open the doors, I say we're going to be working on the time machine, because that's how sophisticated the thing looks. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I wasn't criticizing in any way. It just, the way you're describing your experience up there, it's very human, this combination of state-of-the-art technology and state-of-the-art ingenuity to keep systems going. That's what humans have always done, and you just happen to be doing it in space.
Yeah, so certainly there's a lot of opportunity to be clever in how we keep things working, and a lot of that cleverness goes on the ground, and we just execute their brilliant plans they come up with.
Do you use GPS up there, GPS technology? Can you see the global positioning satellites?
Well, our attitude control system, how the space station is positioned not only in space but over the Earth, does use GPS technology, GPS receivers. We aren't able to see those GPS satellites. Those are in a much higher orbit, and unfortunately, we don't have many great windows looking up. Most of our windows are scientific windows looking down at the Earth.
Describe the year mission, the one-year mission, and the extent to which studying how long you can take space travel and a weightless environment is going to bear on our ability to go to places like Mars.
So a trip to Mars is going to be much longer. It's going to be, maybe 6 months getting there, a long time on the surface, and then a similar amount of time coming back. So we need to better understand the effects of this environment on our physiology, on our bone mass, muscle mass, on our vision, the radiation effects on us on a genetic level. And the space station has incredible capability to do imaging, to collect data, the stuff we're going to need to know to make that trip. So, that's what this flight is about, trying to understand the physical effects, but also the psychological effects of being up here for a long time. You know, not being able to go outside for a year is not necessarily the easiest thing I'm ever going to do, but it's part of what we need to understand better if we are going to set foot on Mars someday, and we will. It's it's just going to take us some learning and some more experience to get there.
What's the most amazing thing about the station, both of you, in a short answer? The thing that really is a testimony to humanity's ability to innovate.
Well, for me, just getting to live and work up here, even in the short time that I've been here, to see this incredible laboratory that has been up here with people living and working in it for almost 15 years now, and it continues to serve as a scientific platform for studies that are going to not only help us get further deeper into space, but also to help improve life on the ground, I think is an amazing thing, and it's an incredible thing to be a part of.
And for you, Scott?
Yeah, so we put this thing together while hurtling around the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour in a vacuum, in extremes of temperature, in this radiation environment where, astronauts and cosmonauts went outside and, bolted these modules together, some of which were never connected on the ground. And the fact that we did this as an international partnership you know, using different standards of engineering and, you know, how we measure things and, you know, how we do things is just a testament, I think, to the ingenuity of, you know, us as a species.
Well, very, very impressive. Scott Kelly and Chell Lindgren, thanks so much. This is WNYC. Thank you, station.
Our pleasure.
Chell Lindgren, flight engineer of Expeditions 44 and 45 to the International Space Station, and Scott Kelly is the U.S. astronaut participating in the one-year mission where he and his Russian cosmonaut, Mikhail Kalmanenko, plan to spend 342 days on the International Space Station. One more innovation to take with you today. A Japanese company is set to open the world's first robot-run farm. From watering seedlings to harvesting crops, this lettuce farm will be fully run by industrial robots when it opens in Kyoto next year. A representative of the company said the move will cut personnel and energy costs by nearly a third. It's not known if they'll be recycling any urine. They still do need humans to do the planting of the seedlings, though. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Weather in Caucusing, Iowa today, partly cloudy. High in the 40s, low in the 30s. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Support for the search for America's greatest innovation is provided in part by the Lemelson Foundation. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.